Hello, I'm Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, and I lead the Justice, Equity, and Opportunity Initiative. Welcome to my podcast series, Walk, Listen, Learn, Our Journey to Justice. Why a podcast? Well, I wanted to combine three things I love: walking, listening, and learning, as the title suggests. I'm also passionate about people and finding engaging ways to discuss issues. So thanks for joining me. Today, we're talking about inequities in health and healthcare, and my guest is Dr. Damon Arnold. Dr. Arnold is the medical director of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois and served 26 years in the Army National Guard, where he served as the commander of the Joint Medical Command and State Surgeon General for 12 years. I should also say that he has been a great resource as my office has talked about health equity and thinking about those issues, particularly as it relates to COVID-19. Welcome, Dr. Arnold.
Welcome. Thank you. Great to be here.
You know what? There's a phrase that really comes up that I have heard you talk about and so many others around the conversation about health equity. Yes. And that phrase is social determinants of health.
Yes.
What does that really mean?
Well, you know, the social determinants of health, for many years, people would come into a medical clinic or a hospital and they would look at your medical condition. So physically, how are you doing? Or mentally, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. But not make that connection to where you were living. So the place that you're living has multiple components. There's these critical infrastructure and key resource sectors people talk about. But these are things like transportation, your educational system, whether you have access to health care, whether you have access to food, whether you actually have a place to walk, to exercise. Sure. You know, so these are the social determinants of health. There are about 19 social determinants of health that have been identified up to this point. But all of these things are impacting people's lives every day. Do you have a refrigerator? Do you have a stove? You know, are you homeless?
Do you have clean water, access to clean water?
Access to clean water. So all of those things sort of act as force multipliers and come together to impact your health. So as you go into a healthcare system, if I have high blood pressure, they don't talk about, well, I was running for a bus and I've had stress in my life every day, just trying to make it from check to check. And that may be impacting my health. So those are the things that we have to got to pay more attention to.
Yeah.
Those are the things that actually make, some people say somewhere between 60 to 80% in various reports, that that is more of a determinant of your health outcome than your actual disease.
And so that's so interesting because I think what you just talked about is that you walk into a clinic, as you said, and you might look at symptoms, you know, what are you feeling? Where does it hurt? You know, what's happening with your body?
Right.
And that's just a part of the picture. That's just a small piece.
That's correct.
That what the conditions are in your home and in your community, that can have a much bigger role in how healthy you might be.
Oh, absolutely. You know, because if you are a child and you get up every morning and you eat, you know, high sugar content diet food and don't really have adequate access to good food because of the social conditions you're in. And those can really tie into things like discriminatory practices. It can also work to disenfranchise people. And for example, for a person who's sitting there, they could, it depends on, you know, your educational status, your, you know, ties into what kind of occupational setting you'll be in, what your ultimate income is going to be, and what your ultimate wealth is going to be. And that actually, that wealth is actually one of the things that gives you the ability to buy a car versus getting onto a bus or a train.
Right.
That also allows you to buy high quality foods versus poor quality foods, especially if you're living in a food desert or a place where they have, you know, very, you know, decreased access to good, nutritious food. So, you know, those things really tie together and they bring you to the table of, are you going to be marginalized? You know, are you going to...
And by marginalized, what do you mean by that? Because we're talking about health in general, but what does it mean? Because we hear that term too, marginalized communities.
Right. Yes.
So how do your social determinants of health sort of project whether you're going to be marginalized.
Okay, so your social determinants of health are really tied to your overall empowerment in your own community. So am I able to go down the street and go to a store and buy fresh fruits and vegetables, for example? If I do not have the economic wherewithal to go to a store because there's no store in my community that sells those, and I don't have a car that can go there, and I have to take a train for 2 hours to get to a place to buy food, that actually directly impacts me and my health.
Yes.
Because I may have been working one job, two jobs, you know, at a low
wage. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And so now this is putting additional stress on me. So as a result, because of the social constructs, I have been marginalized. I've been pushed out of being on a pathway that can actually access the things that I need to stay healthy.
And so I hear you really saying that when you talk about wealth, but under-resourced communities are often the same communities that are marginalized.
Correct.
So you don't have the resources, but then that keeps you away from getting the things you need to be healthy and to move forward in life.
Exactly.
Okay, so it sounds almost like a cycle.
Right.
One of the parts of that cycle that you talked about was access to food and healthy foods.
Yes.
And you use the term food desert. And we hear that term quite a bit as we talk about sort of health and what people need. But what is a food desert? And then I think I've also heard this term food swamp.
Oh, food swamp.
Yeah. What does that mean?
That's even worse.
That's worse. Okay.
That is.
What do these kinds of things mean?
Okay, so a food desert would be a place where, for example, you don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And you have the other things that are nutritious for you. You know, you have other food sources, you know, different things like meats and that kind of thing on a you can put on the table. So that's really a food desert when you don't have access to the nutrition you need to put into your body. What a food swamp is when they are putting products on the shelf that are actually detrimental to your health.
Mm.
So if you're, you know, over drinking alcohol, if you are overeating sugar-laden foods, mm-hmm. that leads to obesity. Mm-hmm. And that can actually cause damage in the blood vessels in your body. And this vascular damage is really the basis of many of the diseases we're seeing. Heart disease, brain disease, kidney disease. And if we allow that to continue, we can end up with diabetes. Hypertension can ravage our bodies. And that is actually a pathway that when we look at COVID-19 right now, it actually is superimposing itself on that same pathway.
Yeah.
And that's why we're seeing so many bad outcomes. So that chronic disease that you develop from not having access to that food or not having access to the things that keep you healthy can actually make it even worse for you in COVID-19.
I'm glad you kind of brought up COVID-19 because, of course, you know, a lot of the work that you and I have been able to do together has been in that context of COVID-19.
Right.
And I think that's why this conversation is so important as it relates to justice, because these issues are almost tied together the way that you're painting this picture, that I don't have access to the things that I need to be healthy in my community.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I then get marginalized. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when a global pandemic hits our, not just our nation, but around the globe, it's those exact same communities, people living in those communities where these social determinants of health are, you know, so present and prevalent around showing why these communities are not healthy, that's where we see higher rates of not just infection or exposure to the virus, but also higher rates of death.
Yes.
Is that the case?
Absolutely.
Kind of tie that knot a little bit more, that bow around how this is all connected as it relates to COVID-19.
Okay, very good. You know, one of the things that happens is that these social determinants of health and that marginalization, that discrimination, those things we were talking about, the social injustice, that actually reinforces the position that a person is in and further disadvantages them. So if you have ill health, you're actually trying to respond from a position of ill health.
Yes.
And still facing those other discriminatory things that are still happening to you. And it can
so
make
like
you more vulnerable.
So it's like hitting you from every side.
Yes, correct.
It's not just the one thing of I have to deal with a health issue. I also have to deal with, you know, the fact that I still have to go to work. I might be making lower wages or the level
That's right.
of stress. And all of those things are hitting you at the same time.
That's right. And when you start looking at that, you know, so if I'm in that particular position where I'm in a community where I have poor housing and I have very overcrowded housing, And this is one of the things I was looking at. You know, I'm helping with the COVID response right now, helping the state a bit. And as I look at that, I think about the social density. That's one of the basic features that we talk about in public health. So if you have a high density area, mm-hmm. the likelihood of you spreading a virus is going to be much greater. So in a lot of the communities of color, they're localized in communities that have high densities.
Sure.
And they don't get to go into the suburbs where they have a sprawl, where you can actually be socially distanced.
Right.
But every human who's in this state actually is susceptible to this virus. It's just a matter of time before this spreads from person to person. And the reason why we're seeing such a high impact is because of the social determinants of health. People being in crowded positions, low-wage earning jobs, have to take public transportation.
And still, just going back to the low-wage earning jobs,
right.
having to still be out. You know, there are a
right.
lot of people
sure.
when the stay-at-home order was issued, there were a lot of people that could not stay at home.
Right.
You know, the essential workers who had to go out, first responders or grocery store clerks or bus drivers and so many others who still had to go out to work.
Yes.
Even in the midst of a stay-at-home order.
That's right. And that was forcing them to do things that were against, what they wanted to do as far as their health is concerned, but they were caught between those two places. You know, do I protect my health? And I still have to protect my family. So there's always a balancing act. And the guidance that was given out by the state was actually spot on. You know, wear your mask, socially distance, you know, wash your hands with soap and water. And if you can't get soap and water, use a disinfectant. Mm-hmm. And those things are really important to keep reinforcing for people. But then there's a reality also that people have to still function and they are caught in a hard place. And this is, you know, I did a couple of tours in Iraq and, you know, in a combat zone. And one of the things I had to keep saying is that, don't you know where you are? This is a crisis. This is a time period where things are not going to be going the way they normally would.
Sure.
So people have to actually figure out, how can I deal with this and confront COVID-19, even with these social determinants of health that are happening? The social determinants of health, I think, have impacted the communities, because we've seen communities of color being disparately impacted all across the board. If you look at the CMS report, there was a CMS report on Medicare. And if you are receiving Medicare, if you are African American, you're 4 times more likely than a white counterpart to be hospitalized. It's 2.5 times more likely for a Latino population, and for the Asian population, about 1.5 times. So when you start looking at that, you start saying, you know, what is going on? It's because of the social conditions people are living in. And
yeah.
it doesn't have anything to do with we're more susceptible to this disease. We're more susceptible because of the social determinants of health in our society.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said that, because there are people yeah. who would seek to almost blame
yes.
people to say, well, it's because you live in a particular way or the choices that you made.
Right.
But when you talk about social determinants of health, you're talking about a lot of things that are beyond someone's control. And are really the function of a lot of different factors, including systemic racism.
Correct.
Yeah.
And systemic racism is part of this. It really plays an integral role in it. It sort of reinforces the social discord and the disorder. And when we start looking at it, you know, it's racism and that kind of thing. But it also is sexism. It's
mm-hmm.
also ageism. It's also, you know, LGBTQ community, and it has to do with the geography too. We
yeah.
we have rural and we have urban communities, and the rural communities don't have as many resources many times.
Especially when we think about health care, which is what we're talking about today. I mean, not only health care, but health care is a big issue in terms of some of the lack of resources found in our rural communities.
Yes. And even access to trauma care and that type of thing, it's more curtailed in those communities, the smaller communities generally, smaller populations, but just as important.
Yes.
So we have to really look at, how people are treated. And I think really the basis of all of this is that we have to treat every human as though they were human. Mm. Every human as though they were human. I mean, when I was at, IDPH, I used to be the director back in the days, but I used to ask people to hold a person in their hand and not to be able to see them, but I wanted them to remove their race. I wanted them to remove their age, their sexual orientation, what type of music they like to listen to.
The neighborhood they came from.
Ethnicity, what they came from, everything. Educational level.
Age.
Everything. And then realize you have a human spirit in your hand that you're supposed to be protecting. And so that's the essence and the core of what medicine should be.
Yes.
Now, when we have the, things like implicit bias coming into the picture.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. What does implicit bias mean? Because what you just talked about is like holding the, and I love that imagery of holding the human spirit in your hand and recognizing that your role as a medical professional, a healthcare professional, is to treat that human spirit regardless of all the other characteristics. But we know that with implicit bias, and that doesn't always happen. What is implicit bias, and how do you really see that impacting communities? Let's talk communities of color or other communities where there are these identifying characteristics that people might have biases towards, including the LGBTQ community and other communities.
Yes, and what if implicit bias, I always like to start with explicit bias because it makes it easier to understand. So explicit is that, someone walks into the room and I say, I don't like you because of your race, or I don't like you because of your ethnicity or your religion. So that's explicit. But when
it's like, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
I don't like you. Yes. Yeah, I see it. I'm telling you, I don't. Okay. Right. And implicit bias, on the other hand.
And implicit bias is really when it is implied that the way that you are acting is actually in a form of bias against another person. So what I mean by that is the way that you were brought up, the way that your psyche is developed, the way that you think about things, how your subconscious motivations are going on, how your body language is coming across. Those kinds of things give keys, or some people call them dog whistles, but these are things that are actually engendered in a person once they encounter something that they have a bias against. So
it kind of bubbles up within you,
right?
Because
correct.
Of how you were raised or the experiences you've had. That's that right. Without being that sort of explicit, I know that I don't like you because I just don't.
That's right.
These are things that you may not even realize are part of your own makeup.
That's right.
Start showing bias towards others.
Yes. And there's one, one commercial I love that's on television now, and it's of this one brother who's an African-American who's walking, and then he, people are following him in the store. They're watching him when he takes his kid into the water, into the swimming pool with them. They're watching him do all these things, right? And it's sort of like they're sort of criminalizing his behavior. Mm-hmm. And then he walks into a courtroom and he's the judge. Mm. So the implicit bias was that you don't even know who you're looking at.
Yeah.
And you're treating this person, like someone other than who they really are.
My first time, I'm a lawyer, and my first time walking into a courtroom, I got in line with the other lawyers. Now, again, this is many years ago, but I got in line with the other lawyers to go check in for my case. And when I got to the clerk, she said, "Oh, this is the line for lawyers. You don't belong here.
Oh,
just have a seat."
See?
And it was one of those moments, and I said, "What about me?" When she looked at me, made her decide I was not a lawyer.
Yes. And the thing is that works on such a deep level, because in her mind, she may not have been wanted to explicitly point you out and say, oh, you are the wrong person to be in this line. It was implied because she was picking you, she was pulling you out of the group.
Yeah.
Not based on any kind of facts or any other kind of knowledge about who you
are. Who I really was, yeah. So that's implicit.
That's implicit.
Ah, great example. I've been waiting all these years to get a word to explain what happened there. So I want to just kind of close out talking just a little bit more, because when you talk about implicit bias and social determinants of health, we know that there are communities that are considered healthy.
Yes.
And there are some communities that are considered unhealthy. We know there are communities with abundance of resources and some that are considered under-resourced. Can you talk just a little bit more about what we need to be thinking about as we think about creating community healthy communities across the board? Because I think that's really something that has really come out of this pandemic, of really having to understand those social determinants of health and how do we change it. But boy, does it sound like such a just a huge task to try to create healthy communities that have been have suffered decades of disinvestment. What do we need to be thinking about? Like, what are some of the things that kind of keep you up at night about what do we need to do to create healthier communities?
Oh, quite a few.
Quite
a few nights up restless.
Yes, I'm sure.
But you know, the things that, you know, my backgrounds, I'm an internist and an occupational medicine specialist. So I did two residencies in public health. And, with some of the things I saw overseas with the military, it sort of put me into a different kind of framework. I think that urban planning is extremely important, but I'm one of those people that really supports things like STEAM, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, arts is in there as well. And the reason why I think that's so important is that that is the basis, the core of what we should be training our children to do. We need to, because we're going into a technological green movement and green environment. Electric cars, all these things are starting to roll out and come on, you know, electric power, solar power. We need to get trained in those jobs so that we have employment. So that employment actually serves as a basis for starting to have an infrastructure that you can maintain.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is that when we went into a lot of these communities, many of us didn't build these houses. You know, we had the migration from the south to the north. And when people went into these houses, there was white flight. So people left these communities.
Right.
But the problem is that you had to maintain property without having a wage income. And you still had to pay property taxes. You still had to do those things to support the infrastructure. So I think, you know, urban planning needs to shape itself around healthy communities, looking at, do you have access to adequate medical health care? Do you have access to healthy foods and the resources, nutrients, so that you don't become sick? We have a medical treatment system. We don't have a medical health care system. We have a medical treatment system.
So after someone is
ill,
after someone is ill, after they have the symptoms, we treat.
We treat.
But we don't have, as you said,
a medical prevention system.
Which says, what do we need to do in communities on the front end to keep you out of the healthcare system, really?
Right, out of illness.
Out of illness, at least, yeah.
Yes. So if we were to develop ourselves and to make sure that our educational institutions were pushing for proper nutrition, training our children how to take care of yourselves, we really don't have that in schools. You know, if you go to schools and they say, well, what do you want for lunch, a cookie or, you know, jelly beans, you know? And so we really need to get that message across beginning at a very early age, even from kindergarten. What do you do to stay healthy? And as you're growing, I think that they will start to use those things to make sure that they're on the right path for that. That also goes to demand. I look in some of the stores that I go into in some of the communities, and what I see on the shelves are chemical warfare agents. Because when it's overseas and they talk about weapons of mass destruction, you know, nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, all that, And it may kill you right away if you get exposed to one of the nerve agents over there. But here, these are like nerve agents on our shelves. Some of the products that are on there are just absolutely disastrous for us. Tobacco products, you know, some forms of alcohol that get you higher than high, right?
Yeah.
That's how they advertise.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, when you talk about prevention,
yes,
you talked about health care, you talked about access to health care, access
yes.
to healthy food, you talked about education, you talked about what's, you know, kind of the economy, what's
right.
on the shelves.
Right.
So to me, when you talk about prevention, it's sort of a, there's a couple of different ways. I think of it sometimes as a chicken or the egg. You talk
right.
about what a young person can learn growing up, but right. that young person also needs a community
that supports it.
That has access to those
yes.
things.
So yes.
it's sort of, we have to address it from both standpoints, but the bottom line is, from right. what I hear you saying, is that it's about choices.
Yes.
You know, when you go into a community, you see only certain things on a shelf and not really a lot of choices.
Right.
Or where there's only, you know, a liquor store on each corner,
yeah.
but no real choices
mm-hmm.
of healthy produce and sort of nutritious food.
Yes.
That's something that comes with a healthier community.
Absolutely.
Having options.
Yes.
Yeah.
Having those options.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a kid, you know, my father was a veteran, my mother, and both of them were smokers, right? So I came home from school one day, and I remember it was like sixth grade, and I walked in and I said, I don't want you to smoke. And they were like, what? I said, I don't want you to smoke. I want you around when I get older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the both of them quit.
Mm.
That was enough to make them quit. So what we need to do is have a wake-up call.
Mm.
We need to have some social action going to these stores and telling them, get that stuff off the shelf. Some of them are outdated products
yeah.
that they're still pushing onto people. We need to go and say, this is what we want in order to have healthy products in our stores, our local neighborhood stores.
And from a restorative justice lens,
yes.
that needs to be led by the community.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, led
yes,
by
it
the
does.
Community to say we want better and we deserve better.
And we deserve better.
Yeah.
We are, you know, when I went overseas and I was, you know, I was in charge of a combat aid station in Mosul, Iraq, and I met Petraeus, General Petraeus in the battlefield, General Ham, and the whole crew. And I was looking at things, and I was looking at how we were functioning as a unit. And we need to have that kind of functionality back here. We need to have a group that is so concerned about saving the lives of people in our community that they're willing to work together to make sure that every aspect of these social determinants of health are covered. If I have someone who is, back in the day, even in Chicago, we had hundreds of deaths one year because of senior citizens being locked in, plastic still on the windows, and there was a heat wave.
During a heat wave, yeah.
And, you know, we could have done something as a community to say, let's take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
We have got to bring compassion back into our community
mm-hmm.
and make sure that we're really looking out for one another as a community. If you don't have that kind of compassion and you don't really support your community, you are predating its death.
Yeah.
You are actually predicting that this is going to be something that's going to happen. And so everyone needs to get up, and do something. It's just like with voting, right? You need to get up and vote.
And we need to make yeah. sure that we are ensuring that our communities are healthy.
That's right.
Dr. Arnold.
And one of the things, I used to
yeah.
wear a mask, right? So you have a wet mask, and some people don't want to wear their mask for
yeah.
the COVID-19. One of the things, when I was overseas, 40 to 60 pounds of body armor. And that was to save your life. They're only asking you to wear 2 to 4 ounces a mask to save your
life.
And if I walk across the street on the way here, if I had walked by someone, a mom or a dad in the street, and I gave them the virus, and then they go and see their child who has cancer in the hospital, and that child dies from COVID-19, I was complicit in that because I didn't, you know, take this seriously enough. So I think it's the same thing with anything that we're talking about, whether it's your food sources, whether it's the way that you take care of yourself personally, whether it's, you know, making sure that you are actually supporting other people and help them, because all of us go through stress as people of color. And some days I'll see some people, you know, who are in stores, and many people go like, oh, that clerk was nasty, that person was, you know. And what I do is I say, you know, I know you're having a bad day, you know, I know, but you're going to get through this. And we need to have that empathy and making sure that we understand what someone else is going through. And we need to speak up. So we need to be speaking up for those kids that get involved in the criminal justice system. Why weren't we there to make sure that they want a better path?
I think that what our conversation today has really pointed out is what I always say, and I kind of alluded to it at the beginning, that justice is not just about policing jails and prisons. Justice is about housing and health care and mental health care. It's about education and access to food and all of the things that you have talked about. And I just want to say, Dr. Arnold, thank you for your kind of bringing it home around our compassion one for another should move us to wanting to make sure everyone is as healthy as they can be. Yes. And I would say that that's especially true right now as we live through this pandemic. Thank you so much for walking, listening, and learning with us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us. That's it for this episode of Walk, Listen, Learn, Our Journey to Justice. Until next time, I'm Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Thank you for walking, listening, and learning with me. Let's stay on this path towards justice, equity, and opportunity for all.